This week, the first known case of Zika virus transmission in the U.S. was reported. The WHO also declared the virus an international public health emergency. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we explore the threat posed by the Zika virus with two specialists here in Iowa, Dr. Andrea Greiner and entomologist Ryan Smith. Then in the second half hour, a new study from Iowa State University that examines the link between negative media stories of Muslims and support for military action and restrictions against Muslims. Coming up, first this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, a new study from Iowa State University that examines the link between negative media stories of Muslims and support for military action and restrictions against Muslims. That's coming up in our second half hour. This week, the first known case of Zika virus transmission in the U.S. was reported that in Texas. Local health officials there said it's likely contracted through sex, not through a mosquito bite. And that came a day after the World Health Organization, the WHO, declared an international public health emergency because of the Zika virus. It's a virus linked to severe birth defects in thousands of babies in Brazil, spreading rapidly in this hemisphere. Zika is now in at least 25 countries and territories in Latin America and the Caribbean. This half hour, two guests join us to better understand the Zika virus and the threat it may pose. Dr. Andrea Greiner is with us, clinical assistant professor in obstetrics and gynecology in the Division of Maternal-Fetal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, joining us by phone. Dr. Greiner, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Ryan Smith is also with us, a medical entomologist and assistant professor at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Fine. Let me start with you, Dr. Greiner,
okay.
The basics of the Zika virus. What is it? How does it spread?
So the Zika virus is a flavivirus, which we will talk more about later, but that was discovered in Africa and is carried by a certain type of mosquito. And if a human is infected or bit by a mosquito, then they can develop symptoms related to that with this fever, rash, joint pain, or red eyes that starts about a couple days to a week after being bitten. But only about 1 in 5 patients actually have symptoms. And so most people have an asymptomatic infection. It passes and it doesn't cause them any trouble.
Mm-hmm. Could it be deadly? Do we know?
Not in most people. There's been some reports out of Brazil of a condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a neurologic effects of this virus that can, in some people, if they have paralysis, can be deadly. But in most people that get Guillain-Barré, those rare cases, it resolves with time and monitoring.
So talk about the recent surge in birth defects in Brazil connected to the Zika virus. How does the virus cause these birth defects? Do we know?
We don't know exactly how it does it, but in the last probably year and a half or so, officials in Brazil have noted an increase in a usually pretty rare type of birth defect called microcephaly. And what that means is that the baby's head is much, much smaller than it should be compared to babies of the same gestational age and gender. And in the last year or so in Brazil, they've had about 4,000 cases and counting of babies born with this. And in the same time, they've noticed an increase in the number of people having infections related to the Zika virus, and they've detected the virus in mosquitoes there. And also there have been some a small number of pregnancies that have been confirmed to have the Zika infection, either because they miscarried or the infant was tested after birth. But it's basically just an association at this point. They haven't, you know, a lot of experts think it's probably related, but as far as maternal infection and then transmission to the baby, all of those details haven't been worked out completely at this point.
And that's nevertheless, women are who are pregnant are being advised not to visit some of these countries, right?
Correct. Yeah, the most recent recommendations from the CDC and the WHO is to recommend that a pregnant woman at any point in her pregnancy to not travel to areas where the Zika virus is known to be circulating. The CDC recommendations are a little bit more conservative and say no travel at all, whereas the WHO is saying, you know, if a pregnant woman has to travel, she should take precautions to avoid mosquito bites.
Mm-hmm. So now, as I mentioned at the outset, a case of a transmission in the U.S., I think there are probably several in the meantime, reported to, through sexual intercourse. What do we know about that at this stage?
Based on what I've read, well, I know that it's causing a lot of people to panic, but based on what I've read is that it's, a pretty rare entity. There have been other cases of sexual transmission reported in other outbreaks. Like there was an outbreak in 2013 in Polynesia, and they had a couple reports of sexual transmission. And the one in Texas is the one that was in the news this week. And then there was another couple who were entomology researchers in Colorado who there was a case of transmission. So I think it's pretty rare, but it is a known possible way that the virus can be transmitted.
Right, and that would be alarming. And if for those who might not realize why, tell us, why would that be alarming if we can get it through a mosquito bite and sexual intercourse?
Well, the concern is that if you can get it through multiple ways, that maybe potentially more people could be infected. You know, like if somebody travels outside, like the case in Dallas, one of the partners had been to Venezuela and then returned home, and then, you know, both of them develop symptoms, and the partner that was in Dallas had not been outside the States. And so the concern is, you know, could potentially more people be affected? And then the questions we've been getting asked here at the university is women who are planning to become pregnant in the near future and also planning, you know, a trip to the tropics, you know, should they be worried? And I don't think we really know how worried they should be at this point.
Can you characterize the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics' reaction to this spike in concern about the Zika virus?
So the overall hospital concern is that it's not an infection control problem like we had with the Ebola virus, you know, because there was Ebola virus can be transmitted person to person, but we think for the most part with Zika, that isn't as much of a concern. So there isn't really a hospital-wide response yet. Most of the focus has been on, for those of us that care for pregnant women, you know, as far as educating them and asking about travel and answering questions. So, you know, both in our department and other departments who see pregnant women, you know, are trying to educate themselves about it.
Okay. Definitely tracking it. It's on your radar.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, I've read no known treatments or vaccine for Zika at this point.
No, just, you know, symptomatic, you know, support, you know, Tylenol for body aches and drinking lots of fluids and rest. But no, there is no antibiotic, you know, that can treat this and no known vaccine at this point that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. And the diagnosis is made through a blood test?
Right. So if somebody reports travel to one of the affected countries and then reports symptoms, then they can have a blood test done that has to be coordinated through the Iowa Department of Public Health, the state hygienic lab, and then the samples are submitted to the CDC for assay.
Ryan Smith, let me turn to you, a medical entomologist and assistant professor at Iowa State University. So let's talk about the mosquitoes, of course, with you as a medical entomologist, being spread through Latin and South American countries. Tell me about what you know further about the kinds of mosquitoes that spread this virus, all types?
No, it's actually a specific genus or family of mosquitoes, primarily Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. Mm-hmm. Which are been primarily implicated in the transmission of the disease.
Mm-hmm. And those specific types of mosquitoes are here in North America, in Iowa, in the Midwest?
Well, they are found in parts of the United States, at least in getting to Iowa. We really don't have a great deal of information regarding their prevalence, but for about the last 45 years or so, we've taken part in a mosquito surveillance program here, and we've only actually counted a total of 12 Aedes albopictus, and we've never actually detected Aedes aegypti here in the state. It's not an all-inclusive surveillance, but with the number of years that we've been looking at this, I think we can pretty much rule out that these aren't native species to Iowa and that they really don't take a major population of the mosquitoes that are here in the state.
Mm-hmm. Given that we have these reports of it rapidly spreading in this hemisphere in at least 25 countries and territories in Latin America, also the Caribbean, how concerned are you about it? It's in North America. It has been transmitted in North America, but has it been transmitted by mosquitoes? It doesn't sound like it has, according to the reports. Is that what you're seeing?
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, to say that it's been transmitted is through sexual intercourse at this point in time. And really, this is kind of a rarity of disease transmission, and you wouldn't really expect that to have much of a public health impact. The real question or really what's going on with disease transmission with Zika is really whether the mosquito is transmitting it from person to person. And all of these cases that have popped up so far in the United States have all been from travel abroad. And so I think what's interesting here in the next couple of weeks is to see if there's actually local transmission that's occurring here in the United States.
Local transmission that's not sexual intercourse?
Right, through mosquito-to-mosquito transmission.
Okay, so that would—
Or human-to-human transmission by a mosquito.
Not be happening at this time of year in Iowa or the Midwest. We're talking about our southern states,
exactly,
though. So
yeah.
Here in the Midwest, we would want to be perhaps just watching this and be concerned when we do get into some warmer temperatures and our little friends decide to come out and seek our blood, right?
Yeah, I mean, if anything is to happen, it would probably be during the summer months. And mm-hmm. so we probably have a few more months to worry about this. But more than likely, I think the chances of Zika transmission here in Iowa are at this point probably pretty rare.
Let me ask you the same question I did, Dr. Greiner. Iowa State University, you're tracking this. How are you reacting to it more generally?
Well, I mean, it's definitely something that is of interest as a medical entomologist. It's definitely something in the news, and I think it's awareness out there, and I think that's really the big key is that as far as disease transmission here in the United States, and especially in Iowa with the cold weather that we have, I don't think it's really a place that naturally harbors these mosquitoes that have been implicated in disease transmission. And I think that the chances of mosquito transmission here in Iowa itself is probably pretty rare.
Mm-hmm. So at the moment, the advice sounds like you're saying to those listening here in the Midwest, stay calm, let's track it, and perhaps when the summer months come around, we may have an update and have to be more careful.
That's exactly right, and I think it's really about being aware of this, taking precautions, avoid getting bit by mosquitoes, and there's still a lot to learn about Zika transmission here in the United States.
I wonder if you can compare Zika virus with what we most connect with mosquitoes, the West Nile virus, other things that are more of a threat to us and have been for several years.
Well, I mean, Zika is in the same family of viruses as West Nile, and actually of dengue and yellow fever, some of these things that have caused disease kind of throughout the world, not only in kind of regional areas of the United States, but it's a very similar virus as far as the types of mosquitoes that carry it. Zika is transmitted by Aedes aegypti and albopictus, whereas West Nile is primarily carried by Culex species. So this is a completely different species of mosquito. Where West Nile transmission here in Iowa actually probably has a better chance of transmission because these Culex species are actually native to Iowa.
Mm-hmm. But is it true that not everyone who gets bit by a mosquito with West Nile ends up getting infected, right?
No, that's exactly right. Humans are actually dead-end hosts for the disease. The natural cycle of disease transmission actually is in birds.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever... it's usually in rare cases that if actually bitten by one of these mosquitoes carrying West Nile, that it actually manifests any systems mm-hmm. Symptoms.
So as a medical entomologist, do you think about do you have to kind of be a profiler of this specific virus, what it wants. You said that the humans are a dead end for it. It really is not very interested in us. We don't help it spread.
Well, that's at least with West Nile. I think there's a lot of questions still out there regarding Zika and its biology. And I don't think that we really know if humans are kind of the reservoir for the disease for it to be transmitted. With some of these viruses, humans are a dead-end host. The virus doesn't amplify in the human, and so it actually, in order to have disease transmission, you need a different host species to go ahead and amplify up the virus so that when the mosquito bites that species, it acquires the virus and then can transmit it to a human, but that's usually as a byproduct of the transmission cycle.
Talking about the Zika virus, upgrade in the threat that is perceived by the CDC and the World Health Organization declaring this week an international public health emergency. If you have any questions about the Zika virus, we have a few more minutes. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Here's an email from a listener, perhaps for Dr. Greiner. What is the period after infection where it will be safe for women to become pregnant without risk?
Oh, my. The short answer is we don't know. The blood test for the Zika virus, in order for it to be, is only known to be positive within a week or so after symptoms. But what we don't know, and maybe Dr. Smith can speak to this as far as how long the virus can stay in the bloodstream. I've not read anything that indicates that, so I don't know, you know, how long women have to wait.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a case where we really have no clue as to a lot of the biology of Zika virus. And at this point, it's one of those areas that's still under investigation to really see how long it is persistent and if there's a specific time frame which could cause the microcephaly, which is so prevalent in Brazil right now.
You mentioned dengue, also carried by mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. I understand, Ryan Smith, that there's been developments there. It's also a threat to the United States. In Hawaii?
Yeah, actually, in about the last 6 months, there's been about 250 dengue cases.
Mm-hmm. And where is that coming from? How is? Give us some more information if you have any.
Well, I don't actually know where how exactly the virus was introduced to the island, but it appears to have been or being actively transmitted on the island itself. And I, at least from what I've read, is that I don't believe that anyone has died from contracting dengue there. But the Department of Public Health for Hawaii is actually implementing control measures and really trying to get at stopping these infections.
Mm-hmm. You also work in your studies with malaria, right?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. What is the latest on malaria? We tend to really not be concerned about that here in North America, but certainly in other parts of the world.
Well, I mean, the effects of malaria are still devastating throughout the world. We kind of live in a little bubble here in North America in which vector-borne diseases are kind of an afterthought, and oftentimes we need something like Zika to kind of remind us of that. Malaria is still causes an estimated number of deaths ranging well above a half million people every year.
Mm-hmm. And what is your work concerning malaria this year at Iowa State University?
My interests are actually looking at the mosquito immune response to see how it actually kills off malaria parasites.
Mm-hmm. So can you engineer a mosquito to kill that?
People can actually genetically modify mosquitoes, and at least in lab purposes, we can more or less create a mosquito that is unable to transmit malaria. Mm-hmm. And people have also demonstrated the same thing with dengue virus as well.
Mm-hmm. And is that the way forward to reduce the spread of malaria, the threat of malaria worldwide, or to even wipe it out at some point?
Possibly. I mean, there's a lot of social implications with if you are to release some of these genetically modified mosquitoes. But the technology is definitely there. It's up to us as a community to help improve that and alleviate any possible risks. Mm-hmm. We definitely have the technology. And kind of with the advent of CRISPR-Cas9, I think that we can actually spread these mosquitoes into a population now.
Zika, malaria, dengue, are there any other nasty things that mosquitoes carry around that you're studying, Ryan Smith?
Well, the other thing that we've kind of talked about that is kind of on the outskirts of the United States right now is chikungunya, which is another type of virus that is
chikungunya?
Carried by...
Chikungunya?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
It is carried by mosquitoes. Just in 2014, there was a huge outbreak in the Caribbean, but it didn't really seem to take hold in the United States too much. But again, it was is very similar to Zika, in which a lot of people who were traveling in these regions brought cases back to their own respective states.
Right, and I believe Florida is a state affected by chikungunya?
To some extent, I believe there's even some incidents of local transmission.
An email from a listener, I don't know if this was directed at the Zika or perhaps the chikungunya. This listener asks, "What is? I am traveling to Florida to visit family in May. So what would you recommend for that person?"
Well, this is not, a fear worry. I think it's just take normal precautions. If you're going to go outside for extended periods, wear mosquito repellents, wear clothing that will kind of protect your body. And and that's really all that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
More than likely, that mosquito that bites you isn't going to have be infected anyway.
Let's end with this. This has popped up in the media. Perhaps this or last week was the first time people heard about the Zika virus. What is your reaction to some of the reporting about Zika? Is it maybe give you the Goldilocks question? Is it too hot, too cold, or just right, Ryan Smith, in terms of threat assessment?
In terms of threat, oftentimes threat is looked at by the number of deaths or mortality, and up to this point, Zika hasn't, to my knowledge, led to anyone to die. Obviously, the big hubbub is with microcephaly, which is a devastating aspect of the disease. And so I think it's the hubbub, I think, is at least relevant. As far as fear and worry, at least here in the United States, I don't know if we're quite at that point.
Okay. We have a little less than a minute. Dr. Greiner, can I give you the last few words here about the threats? Listeners wondering how worried they should be about the Zika virus.
I think, if they're pregnant and planning to travel to one of the affected areas, I think they probably should stay home. I think there's just too much information we don't know, and microcephaly is devastating. And if they were to have, an infection or an asymptomatic infection and have an affected baby, it would be potentially terrible. And so I think, be cautious and think about, is it more important to take your tropical vacation, which always sounds good in Iowa in February, but, think about the potential long-term consequences to, a pregnant fetus.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Andrea Greiner, a clinical assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. So thanks to Ryan Smith, a medical entomologist and an assistant professor at Iowa State University. Thank you for this comprehensive look at the threat of the Zika virus, helping us understand that. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about a new study from Iowa State University that examines the link between negative media stories of Muslims and support for military action and restrictions against Muslims here in the United States. We'll talk with the study's co-author, Craig Anderson, also Imam Taha Tawil of the Mother Mosque of America that's in Cedar Rapids. We'll come back with that conversation in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Anti-Muslim sentiments have been one of the hallmarks of the current presidential race. However, months before this presidential campaign, Craig Anderson and his colleagues at Iowa State University conducted a series of studies to gauge the influence of media coverage portraying Muslims as terrorists. And according to their results, published in the journal Communication Research, there is a link between negative media stories of Muslims and support for military action and restrictions against Muslims. Craig Anderson joins us now from our studio in Ames, distinguished professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be back.
So give us, what is the question you looked at? What were you trying to find out and why?
The basic question actually comes out of decades of research on different kinds of media effects. And in this case, we were wondering whether portrayals of a particular minority in a negative light in news programs would have an impact on beliefs about that group and support for actions against that group. And, of course, the group that was of most interest to us because of world events over the last decade or two was Muslims, Muslim Americans as well as Muslims in other countries. It has become kind of apparent from some other studies that for many people, if you use the word terrorist, they automatically think of Muslims. Or if you use the word Muslim, they automatically think of terrorism. And we think that that's largely because for many people, that's their only real contact with Muslims is through news. And you know, you tend to have a lot of negative news stories.
Mm-hmm. And so you had the study subjects here do what?
We actually ran three different studies. Two of them are very, very similar, so I'll sort of lump those together. Basically, we had a questionnaire study, a survey kind of study, with which combined these two samples, a little over 900 people. We asked them questions about things like, for example, how much or how often they've seen news stories that portray Muslims as terrorists. And then we also measured their support for taking military action against Muslim countries, as well as support for civil restrictions against Muslim Americans, civil restrictions such as taking away their right to vote, subjecting them to annual security checks, and so on. And we also had a number of other variables were measured really as control variables. So we have political orientation, for example, as one kind of control variable, because we know that political orientation is correlated with support for war, basically, and tends to be correlated with anti-Muslim sentiment. What we found in this correlational study was that people who reported that they have seen more news stories that portray Muslims as terrorists were also more supportive of military action against Muslim countries and were more supportive of restricting the civil rights of Muslim Americans.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what is surprising there, or perhaps it isn't surprising. When I think of, well, the only situation that comes to mind for me, you said this has been studied for decades. After Pearl Harbor, a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment, and in fact, our country put many of them in internment camps. So
right.
Is this different than that somehow?
I suspect that the basic mechanisms are pretty much the same. If all the information you have about some minority group comes from one source and that source hammers on negative kinds of events, you're going to develop negative stereotypes and prejudices about that group. One of the things that was perhaps kind of surprising, though, was that this effect occurred even after you control for a whole bunch of things like age and sex and political conservatism and several other kind of trait variables that this persists, that this is a real effect here. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we did that allowed us to make stronger sort of causal statements is we ran an experimental study, sort of a short-term experimental study, in which participants were randomly assigned to view one of three clips, news clips. These are all real news clips, or to a no-clip control condition. So some of them watched a news clip about the 2007 attempted terror attack at Fort Dix, at which a number of Muslims were arrested for that. Some of the participants watched a neutral clip that had to do with, in Dearborn, Michigan, a school board decided to change football practice times during Ramadan to help accommodate the Muslim students in the school. So it doesn't, you know, portray Muslims either positively or negatively, but it's just sort of, you know, portraying Muslims as, you know, these are real people with, you know, real beliefs and so on. So then we a third group showed a brief news clip about Muslims volunteering in Detroit during Christmas to help fellow citizens. You know, so it's showing Muslim Americans in a positive light. And again, then there's a fourth group that didn't see any video before they everyone completed measures of how much they supported civil restrictions on Muslims, how much they supported military action, and also another measure of their beliefs about Muslims as being inherently aggressive or violent. And what we found was that these brief news clips, this one brief exposure, influenced all three of these variables. That is, those who had just seen the stereotypical Muslims attack kind of news story showed an increase in their perceptions of Muslims as aggressive relative to the to those who hadn't seen a clip. And interestingly, those who had seen the positive Muslim news clip showed a decline in their perception of Muslims as aggressive. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened for the other two main variables. People who just saw a news clip of Muslim terrorists that increased their support for civil restrictions on Muslim Americans and also increased their support for military action in Muslim countries. So we sort of have kind of glass half full, glass half empty.
What do you find most troubling about this taken altogether, your studies?
Well, part of it is that you think about restrictions of civil rights. I mean, you have to realize that you can't single out on the basis of the Constitution. You can't single out a group on the basis of race or religion or anything else and say, oh, we're going, you know, you're not like a real American, so we can't. And yet people were endorsing that kind of statement. Says, oh, yeah, we should make them all get security checks and we should not let them vote.
Donald Trump said no Muslims should come to the U.S. There should be a ban.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, what makes this study or this set of studies kind of very, very timely. I mean, these studies, we started running these a couple of years ago. You know, it takes that long to get all the data and get things published. But the fact that it got published in this election cycle helps to highlight the harm that some of the political candidates are doing to average Muslim Americans. It's, you know, scapegoating them for things that, you know, they haven't done and that they don't believe in. So,
right. So what is what is the takeaway for us, for media consumers and news media producers or media producers?
Right. Well, you know, we've all been thinking about that quite a bit lately. And, you know, from the standpoint of media producers, you know, we're not saying, you know, don't show negative things about Muslims or other minority groups. I mean, you know, the news reporters have to report the news. But I hope that they can that this study will lead both listeners and news producers to realize how much an effect a one-sided set of stories has on the viewers and listeners of those stories. There are a lot of positive things in the U.S. done by Muslim Americans. And it might be worthwhile to try to balance some of the news coverage by seeking out some of those stories and publicizing them. And it's not just, you know, we were focusing on Muslim Americans here, but the same thing happens for other minority groups as well, that they tend to be identified with bad things that happen. But, you know, good news reports seemingly don't attract enough viewers, at least according to the way news shows are produced, I suppose.
Craig Anderson is with us, distinguished professor of psychology at Iowa State University in Ames, talking about a new study, co-author of a study that finds that stereotypes and negative media coverage of Muslims correlate with support of military actions in the Middle East, also cultural ideas that that the beliefs of Islam are aggressive. Also joining us for the remaining minutes of this hour, Taha Tawil, Imam at the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids. Welcome back to our program, Imam Tawil.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening along to the results of Craig Anderson's studies here. What's your reaction?
Well, I was praying for him that he did a wonderful job. And we need more research and more studies like that, because that's the only way that we will get our freedom back, our dignity back. We will get back our citizenship through these type of research and these type of, talks.
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of how the Muslim community you're aware of in Cedar Rapids, around Cedar Rapids in Iowa, has been impacted by the media reports of Islamic terrorists in this country, ISIS-inspired terrorists, or outside of this country. How has that impacted just common everyday Iowans, Americans who were born here, have lived here for generations?
Well, because of the distance, and we don't have access to what's going on in the Middle East, so we just always, like any American, listen to the news, pray for them, hoping that they will figure it out by themselves how they can get along. But the sad part is the politicians and some of those who are hired to inflame the situation by spreading hate and spreading rumors and the stereotype, in another way, lying about the Muslims in America. And that's what hurt us as Muslims. So the reaction, some of the families in Iowa, they said, I am scared with what Mr. Donald Trump is saying. I'm scared with what the media is reporting us. And we find out that it is always like that. If somebody rob a bank by name Mike, then it is just somebody by name Mike from Ames or Cedar Rapids rob a bank. But if that person was by name Muhammad or Ahmad or Jamal or things like that, then it will be like a terrorist. And then they will go to the mosque, to the who is this, to find his family, to find his teachers, his society. I mean, they will stretch it. We have so many incidents happen in America, over 350 incidents. Unfortunately, it happened by non-Muslims. And unfortunately, two incidents betrayed to be Muslims, the one in California and the one in Florida. And because of that, they were labeling only these two as terrorists, but the rest of 350 was labeled as incident or problems or somebody shooting in a theater or a church, mm-hmm. and things like that, without referring to his religion, to what community he belonged to, without going to their churches or their synagogue or their temples, without doing anything except for Muslims. Whenever a Muslim or happen to be a Muslim, then everything else tied with religion.
Craig Anderson, let me ask you about that point. Have you studied that we see that the news media tends to look at violent acts, terrorist acts, killing, bombs, and so forth, just differently when they're by people with Islamic names?
We haven't done any research of that kind, but it's. Almost certainly true. I mean, you don't ever hear a news report for some shooting saying, "Oh, this shooter was Christian."
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Let me go. We're running out of time. I want to go back to Imam Tawil here because you've put on some interfaith events. You're planning a new one. You had one a few weeks ago. This is an attempt at outreach also to counter some of the perceptions we've been talking about. How did that go?
Well, so far, so good. We do so much of interfaith activity, and that is the boat that we are riding in to survive as a community with dignity and the freedom and full citizenship is only through interfaith. And we did one, and it was very successful. The day we have it, the Islamic Center of Cedar Rapids was backed. In fact, there was no enough parking. I mean, the people circulate around the mosque. The other thing, when they get out of it, we ask, how do you think? What do you think? They said over 99.9, it was positive feeling. It was a great, I didn't know that. This is great. This is positive. And now we are having another interfaith, the Islamic Center of Cedar Rapids is opening its doors again on Sunday, February 21st, from 3:30 to 5:30, to say, come and know about your neighbors, all what you need to know about Muslim neighbor. And this type is a part of the activity. The other thing the Islamic Center we do is the Middle Eastern dinner. Last year, the year before, sometime we have over 1,000, 2,000 attendees in the morning and in the evening. Mm-hmm. They come for lunch, they come for dinner, they see the Muslims, they take a tour at the mosque, we give them handout, and we ask the community to check us out, to check the website, the Mother Mosque website, the Islamic, the crmosque.org. Also, and to find out about their neighbors.
Okay.
We are Americans, and we need them to ask questions.
Coming quickly to the end of the hour, I want to get Hassan calling from Cedar Rapids, listening quickly on. We don't have much time, Hassan, but please, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I couldn't help it. Salamataha, nice to hear your voice again.
Thank you, brother.
I turned the radio on, couldn't help but have to call in and make a couple of comments, if I may.
Quickly, please.
The first thing is stereotypes and textbooks about Muslims have existed since I went to school in elementary school. But the one point I wanted to make is that the Muslims that are most vulnerable to any stereotype and discrimination among people that usually are just fearful of what they're hearing are the women that wear hijab because they're easily identifiable and they are very vulnerable. I feel that it's a shame that unfortunately, some of these women get picked on just because of the way they dress.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Hassan, thank you.
I wanted to make that point.
Thank you very much. Hassan. Good observation in Cedar Rapids,
and
Hassan.
Great show. Thanks for doing the work, Professor.
Yeah, okay. Very much welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Hassan, in Cedar Rapids. Very quickly, before we have to go, Imam Tawil, let me ask you, last time we talked in January, you spoke about your desire to invite Donald Trump to come to your mosque to meet Iowa Muslims in your community. Did you get a response? Did you send out an invite? Did you get a response from the Trump campaign?
Unfortunately, we did not get any response nor any one even from his camps just to recognize us or to say, well, we heard about it. We want to thank you, or we are not able to do it now. But you know what? As neighbors, we pray for him, and we will keep the invitations open till he has the time.
What do you think about the caucus results? Donald Trump finishing second among GOP caucus goers with 24% support of the GOP caucus goers. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I will say this is the American value. I feel he was in a different perception. He was way high in his imagination, but reality hit. And I think with that, he needs to wake up and he needs to know that we American citizens, we will find out who is the best to represent our country and to represent our people.
Okay, thank you, Imam Tawil. Very quickly before we go, Craig Anderson, you've been doing all this research on perceptions of Muslims and connection with the media. What has been the reaction to your work from the public? Have you had, because this is such a controversial topic, we only have, I'm sorry, 30 or 40
sure.
seconds.
Interestingly, about 30 minutes after the press release went out, we got our first hate email.
So, really?
Yeah. But I haven't actually gotten any others since yesterday morning. So
you have some follow-up studies planned on this issue?
I'm sure that my colleague Muniba Saleem, who's now at the University of Michigan as a faculty member, I'm sure she's following up on some of this. And yes, we have some additional studies planned.
Okay. Craig Anderson, thank you very much, as always. Very interesting to hear about your fascinating studies there at Iowa State University. Craig Anderson, Distinguished Professor of Psychology, thank you.
You're very welcome, Ben.
And, of course, always glad to have Taha Tawil, Imam at the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids. Thank you, Imam, for being with us.
God bless America. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. We had help from Jason Burns in Ames today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow it's a News Buzz Day. Hope you'll tune in for that. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.